A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on September 22, 1991, entitled, The God Who Delights in Our Delight. Scripture readings are Genesis 2, verses 4 through 9 and 15 through 25, and Revelation 22, verses 1 through 5. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 2, verse 8, and Revelation 22, verse 2. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Well, if I were to ask you this morning, what is the most important biblical story? What is the most important biblical narrative? Or what is the most important biblical theme? What would you say? I suppose we would have quite a variety of responses to that. What seems to you to be that matter of all importance, that one central theme? Would it be the incarnation of the Word, the presence of God in the flesh of Jesus? Would it be the story of the cross and resurrection? As you think about your spiritual experience, as you think about the Scriptures, as you have been nurtured in them, what's the heart of it for you? Some weeks or months ago, I suggested to you that as a church, we have been obsessed with redemption, with salvation, with our sin and its guilt, God's grace and forgiveness, as though the only thing that God was about in the world, and the only thing that had any real draw on our attention, was the matter of salvation. I suggested to you that perhaps that was not necessarily true. That maybe there was a pie, and salvation history, our alienation and reconciliation through Jesus Christ, is but a piece of the pie. But the pie itself is the whole cosmic scope of God's purpose. The kind of statement on the front of that brochure, joining God's agenda, that God, moving through the eons of time, we'll gather all things together in a unity in Jesus Christ, realizing God's purpose from the beginning. That maybe creation is the all-embracing theme within which, thank God, we have the salvation theme as well. This morning, I want to suggest to you that the creation theme is not only that all-embracing theme within which we experience God, the God of covenant grace, but that creation theme has a wonderful message for us that I think we too seldom think about, and I must say I have preached on and taught all too little. I'm always amazed that being at this advanced age on the springtime of my senility that I can still learn new things from the Bible. That stuff that is as familiar as the back of my hand, that I have known from a child, suddenly leap out at me and say something that I never saw there before. Now I know you'll remember a couple of years ago when I preached on Genesis 2 and 3 and made the point that you had to hold Genesis 2 and 3 together, that the chapter separations really had nothing to do with the message. In fact, they detracted from what was one unified story, that the movement from the creation of Adam and Eve and the placement in the garden and then the temptation and the snitching of the fruit, the alienation, disobedience, and expulsion from the garden, that all of that was of a piece. That was one story. And the point I was trying to make then was that it's not like Genesis 1 has one creation account and Genesis 2 has another creation account, and then you get to Genesis 3 and you have the story of the fall. No. Genesis 3 can't be separated from Genesis 2. Genesis 2 and 3 are the story focused on the creation of the human person, the call to responsible freedom and obedience, the failure, the judgment, and the alienation. It's all one piece. But you know what occurred to me this summer? As a team, we were trying to conceive of this year upon which we are now embarking. The thing that occurred to me was that I had always gotten into Genesis 2 in order to get to Genesis 3. I never simply dawdled in the garden. And this morning, I want to invite you to linger in Eden for a few moments, in order that we might delight in the God who delights in us. Delight. It's a restaurant in Grand Haven. They have big breakfasts. Delight. Not a very heavy word, is it? Delight. Oh, I'm delighted. Oh, I'm simply delighted. Oh, you delight me so. But you don't really come to church to be delighted. I mean, it's a little light for church, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to get up on Sunday morning and get all polished up and make your way over here, we ought to be dealing with something a little more substantial, shouldn't we? Something a little more gray and gloomy and glum. Hadn't there ought to be a heavy dose of guilt reinforcing all of the negative feelings we have about ourselves anyway? I mean, if you're going to come to church, shouldn't I make it worthwhile for you and make you suffer just a little bit? Squirm just a little bit? I mean, if the news is too good, if we would waste a Sunday morning on delight, might you as well have slept in? Whenever I try to deal with something like this, I have an image of my father who wanted it heavy. I remember a seminary professor, unfortunate enough to come down and preach in my home church one morning. He was a particularly perky type, and he preached a sermon on heaven. And my father said to him, at the end of the morning, "Now tonight, tell us how to get there." You see, God does visit the sins of the fathers on the children, because every time you do that to me, I'm just probably picking it up from, you know, the judgment on my father's sin. I mean, what an awful thing to say to a minister, right? A guest minister. Dad liked it heavy. He was serious. And I probably, were he not in the delight of the presence of the Lord at this time, I probably wouldn't yet dare preach a sermon on delight. Your Father never fully leaves you. But how about it? What do you think? Might we be different if we were to linger in Eden for a while before we rushed to that tragic episode of disobedience, revolt, alienation, and gloom? Might it be possible for us to be marked by Eden rather than to be marked by the fall? Might we feel differently about who we are and what human potential is and what God's intention for humankind might be if we could linger for just a little while in Eden? You know what Eden means? The word itself means delight. And it is a story full of delight. It is this marvelous, symbolical tale of the Creator taking a scoop of mud, forming a human person, breathing in life, and then saying, "Oh my goodness, I wonder now what I'm going to do with him." And so God plants a garden in the east, Eden, a place of delight, a walled garden, as it were, with animals and birds and trees and flowers, a garden with four rivers coming out of an arid land. You see, they understood the importance of lots of water to make the undergrowth lush. This wonderful garden of delight. And God says, "I'll put this man there." And then God watches this creature until this creature comes to the realization that something's lacking. God says, "Here are all of the animals, name them." And all of the animals are named: elephants and giraffes and hyenas and wolves and dogs, cats, I suppose. And then the man experiences some lack. And it's obvious that God is not going to fill that lack. And yet it's not possible that any one of these animals will fill that lack. And it's not good that this man should be alone. And so we have the delightful story, another surprising story of creation, where the man is put to sleep and God removes the rib. Removing not something from the head in order that the woman might dominate, nor from the foot in order that the woman might be trod upon, but from the rib in order that the woman and the man might stand in reciprocity and mutuality and equality. We have, from that deriving of the woman from man, suffered a great deal of sexism in our society, as though because the woman came from the rib, the woman was derivative. But the intention was not to say that the woman was derivative. The woman was equal. Here was one that was truly fit to be a partner, And the man and the woman stood in equality and mutuality in the lushness of Edenic delight. And what a wonderful story this is, of a gracious, abundant, provident, giving God who seems to delight in the prodigality of the beauty and the wonder of the garden. And the man and the woman, the man and the woman in true mutuality, looking at each other and being surprised and filled with joy, being naked, not ashamed. Just coming back from Europe, I saw a lot of nakedness again. We were in Rome and there was a statue and the fig leaf was well in place. And I said to our guide, "I suppose that's a Christian fig leaf." And she said, "Oh yes, with that statue out in front of what was a Vatican palace, there would have to be a fig leaf in place." But Europe is so much more open, so much more earthy than we are. I'm always impressed with that when I get back. We are so uptight. I don't know where it came from. The body embarrasses us. We don't know what to do with the body. But in the garden, in this place of Edenic pleasure, they were naked and not ashamed. Last year, someone came to one of our education hours and had a film clip about the nudes in European art, and made the point that the nude is always posed. But in the garden, they didn't pose. They weren't nude. They were naked. They were transparent. They were authentic. Here was man and woman in perfect transparency and mutuality and equality, dwelling in the lushness of a garden. I cannot pronounce Latin, but in one of the commentaries I was reading, there was a Latin phrase that spoke about, translated into English, paradise voluptuous. Now, voluptuous only says one thing to me. And that just shows how narrowly I have confined voluptuousness. God would have the man and the woman dwelling in a voluptuous place, beautiful, resplendent, with flowers and trees and birds and animals, in harmony with that created order, in harmony with one another, and in harmony with God, walking in the cool of the evening. Beautiful picture, isn't it? Delight. And I realized this summer, as I was thinking about all of this, that I've always seen Genesis 2 as a setup for Genesis 3. Like Genesis 3 and the so-called fall was the controlling story of the whole story. When, as a matter of fact, Genesis 2 has an integrity of its own. The intention of God for the creature to be dwelling in harmony, in mutuality, in the wonder of the created order, in the resplendent of the garden. God's intention for this wonderful, humane existence. A friend of mine studied with A.A. Van Ruler of the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands, and my friend always talked about Van Ruler, whose stress was always on creation and who had made the point often enough that the church was all obsessed with a little narrow redemption theme, as though the most important thing in the world was that our sins were forgiven and our souls were saved, as though God was not about something grander than that. But I came across some lines that my friend quoted of Van Ruler. God delights not only over God's own being and works. God takes delight also in human beings, in what humans do, and especially over the human delight. Men and women delight over God's delight for them. Here we are in a state of full redemption. And my friend goes on to say, could it be that the ultimate human response to God is delight? Delight in the God who delights in us and who delights in our delight, in a kind of ecstatic dance back and forth, the electricity moving between heaven and earth, a dance of delight. What would happen if our lives were marked by delight rather than guilt, fall, alienation? You say, oh, but what about the reality of alienation and guilt and dis-ease? I say, ah, listen, time enough for it, space enough for it. I came into the ministry believing that it would be incumbent upon me to convince my people of their unworthiness and their guilt. And now, 100 years later, I know you come to church convinced of that. The real task is to get you to linger long enough in Eden to believe that God delights in you and to release you from that bondage that has been bound up in you for so long, that bondage that has never allowed us to lift up our eyes and to delight in the God who delights in us. Maybe delight isn't so light after all. Maybe if we lingered a while in Eden, it might wash over us that the news is better than ever yet we've dared dream of. That God is about a grander scheme than we've yet conceived of. And that the delight of God, God's playfulness with this cosmic order and these people He has shaped and formed to be over against Himself or herself in order that there might be communion, interaction, relationship. The relationship of the man and the woman would be simply sign of a communion, a transcendent communion with God, known in that relationship between the man and the woman, or the man and the man, or the woman and the woman. That in the human relationship, there would be the mystery of another presence, and that together with God, we might at least dream of Eden and believe that that dream will yet come true, For the story in Genesis 2 is not a story of something occurred in history, as though at 6 a.m. on the first day of creation, God called everything into being, and at 6 p.m., Adam ate the apple. It's not that kind of thing. It's not a story that happened once upon a time. It is a story about every person in every age. It is a story about our human condition. It is the story about what God intends, that we would dwell in delight. And it is a pointer to that final vision, which is also not within the stream of history, but beyond it. That final vision of the New Jerusalem, of the city, of the throne, and of the crystal river that flows down Main Street, on whose banks a tree with fruit and leaves for the healing of the nation. The Bible begins in the delight of a garden, and its closing vision is the wonder of the city of God. And if we could only be marked by Eden, we would live more with the vision of the city, and we would rest in the grace and the goodness of the God who delights to delight us and delights in our delight. Isn't that good? Thanks be to God.